Life Audio.
The Mama Take Heart podcast with Rabrina Rettle is brought to you by Life Audio and is a part of our Faith Toolkit series. For more inspirational, faith-affirming podcasts, visit lifeaudio.com.
You're listening to Mama Take Heart, Understanding Your Gen Z Girl, a show designed to help you be the compassionate, gospel-centered, and influential voice in your girl's life. I'm your host, Rabrina Rettle. April is Autism Awareness Month. Joining us today is Sherry McPhee. Sherry's degree in elementary and special education has prepared her to be a special education and kindergarten teacher. Sherry, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
I'm glad to be here.
I want to let people know how we know each other. So I actually know Sherry as Miss McPhee because she was my children's kindergarten teacher. Actually, I think Savannah only had you for one day, I think, right? I think she got moved to another class.
I had her the whole school year. So she
was in Miss Green's class and then she got moved to.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
And then Satchel had you and Miss Baugh 2 years yes. later. And so Sherry was an awesome kindergarten teacher, very loving to her students. And both my kids to this day, they still love Miss McPhee. They're 18 and 20. So I still remember and love her. So that is how we know each other. And then we've kind of run into each other throughout the years at school functions, because we also have children that were in around the same age or in high school around the same time. So anyway, we've seen each other throughout the years. And then I remember I met your husband when he was at the Children's Museum. And then I used to run into him all the time. Once I met him, like, I was like, hey, there you are again. Anyway, so we just kind of run into each other. I call Lincoln a big, small town because it's a larger city, but it's really like a small town because you see the same people a lot. So anyway, that's how we know each other. And in recent years, we started following each other on Facebook, and I had seen some of your posts because I did not know, even though I have known you for those many years, I did not know that you had a child who's on the autism spectrum or was diagnosed with autism. So once I started seeing those posts, I was like, oh, wow, I never knew that. And so I reached out, and Sherry graciously, we met for coffee or hot cocoa. And Sherry was gracious enough to say she would join me in a conversation about her experience. And so here we are.
Yes, here we are. Ready to talk. Okay.
All right. So first, I just wanted to know, how old was your child when you received the diagnosis?
So he was 6 years old. He was in kindergarten. He's a September birthday. And so we knew when he started kindergarten that this was going to be kind of a year where we may see why some of the behaviors we had seen might be there. I had taught kindergarten at that point for about 10 years. So I knew what type of things he should be doing and where he should be at. Mm. Academically, he was where he needed to be in kindergarten. Socially, he was not. And so we knew that there might be some concerns coming up. We did talk to his teacher just slightly. We didn't want to put a lot of things there, but we just said, hey, a heads up, we have some concerns. Any ways that you could let us know what we, you know, need to do or where we should go from here? We just want you to have an open eyes and open heart. So fortunately for us, my husband was able to come in and do like parties since I was doing parties in my room. And by the fall party, which is usually, you know, mid-October, he was like, oh, whoa, that was not great. That was, you know, he's definitely not where he needs to be. We started the process at that point in time. The school psychologist started doing lots of checklists. We went to our pediatrician and got referred to a psychologist. And so he was identified through the public school system by using the autism spectrum disorder checklist. They mm-hmm. did interviews. They did time on task samples. They did actual diagnostic tests. And I should have looked it up before. It was kind of weird. We just did his 3-year reeval. And I was like, Oh, yeah, that's the name of that test that they use. And it goes back and shows all the history of how he was diagnosed and what test they used. But it was on a scale of 1 to 10, and anything over 7 was most likely autism spectrum, and he was an 8.9. So they went ahead and said, yep, he is got autism. That was his initial diagnosis that has followed him all the way through. He's 18 now, and that still is his primary diagnosis. So,
Okay. So, and we'll look up that test and we'll put a link to it in the show notes. So let's talk about the early signs, because you said that there were some things that you felt were amiss from your experience from being a teacher, understanding milestones, where your child should be at a certain age or months, even when they're little. So what were the early signs that you began to detect?
So some of the early signs were, and some we didn't notice until we think back on what we know about autism now. Mm-hmm. So from an early age, by at least 6 months old, we were noticing, we noticed now the repetitive things that he did that we didn't realize were part of autism. He always needed you to put him to bed the exact same way. He always patted us on the back when we patted him on the back. He had some self-stimming things. He always rubbed his ankles on his sheets in his crib, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until they bled. So just some little things like that. By 2, we were like, wow, what a quiet, nice little calm boy that we have. He was obsessed with trains by the time he was a year old. He would play with trains and line them up wheel after wheel after wheel, just on the floor to look at them. He knew their colors, he knew their names. He did the Thomas the Trains, which was a thing that you sometimes see that children on the autism spectrum really loves. So he did all of those things from a very early age. By 3, we had started him in a 2-day-a-week kind of playtime preschool, because he did daycare at home. We had a nanny that came to our home while I was working. And so he just had his siblings to play with. So by 3, we had started him in this program. And he still, to this day, wears his emotions on his sleeve. You knew if he was happy. You knew if he was sad. You knew if he was mad. But it was just more extreme than what you would see in most 3-year-olds. It was very intense. And if he was very upset, it might take him 30 minutes to calm down. So we were like, whoa. So we thought at the time, you know, he's only 3 years old. He may not be ready for a structured setting like that. We pulled him out after a couple of months, let him continue to play at home. We tried again at 4 in a different preschool setting that was maybe a little bit less structured and more play. And we just saw those same type of things. Smart as could be, understood things, was picking up his alphabet, doing all the things that he needed to do academically as a 4-year-old, but socially and emotionally, he still wasn't where 4-year-olds were at. Mm-hmm. And so those are the early things that we saw. So by then, I do have a special education degree. I did know that I'd worked with children on the autism spectrum. I did know that some of those things might be it, but I also knew that we have some bipolar that runs in our family, you know, and obviously you don't want to know that a 4-year-old is bipolar, but I also knew there could be some mood lability as there as well. So we kind of had by that age and being in a structured setting like he was, even though it wasn't as structured as the earlier preschool, we were kind of like, there is definitely some signs there. We did that same preschool at age 5, since he wasn't, well, he was 4, going to be 5, since he just barely made the deadline to go to kindergarten that year. At that point, Lincoln Public Schools, you could join kindergarten if you were 5 by October 15th. Mm-hmm. And his birthday is September 24th. We chose not to send him, hoping to give him another year of maturity with those emotional social issues. Mm-hmm. So those were those definitely early signs that we know now very, very well. Unfortunately, can see them in other kids. We have a niece who's 7 and she was diagnosed with autism at 3, just because we were able to know that some of those signs she was showing were not where she should be at 3 years old. So, yeah.
And so you encouraged your...
I encouraged my brother and his wife to go get her tested. She is nonverbal. So some of that was too, that at 3 years old, she wasn't talking, but there was the repetitive behavior. There was the frustration at times. Now that they've gotten some of the frustration worked out. She's the happiest little kid ever, but she still is nonverbal. So,
So what are the differences, or are there differences between boys and girls on the autism spectrum?
I have seen it be, I mean, so yes, there are differences. And sometimes what you'll notice is that, so I had two different students that I worked with years ago that were on the autism spectrum that were girls, and they were diagnosed at a much later age than a boy. Usually the boys, they're a little bit easier to recognize just because they have more energy. They maybe sometimes more aggressive. If they're verbal, they verbally express stuff more. Mm-hmm. Whereas with a girl, both girls that I worked with weren't diagnosed till fourth grade. And at that point, the teachers were like, they're shy. They're kind of withdrawn. They, you know, just don't, I think that they'll eventually, if they get less shy, they'll be a part of the conversation more. Mm. They had different behaviors that you could see than others. Now, that's not all girls and boys. Mm-hmm. That's just more what you see, because it definitely is a spectrum, and every kid that you meet is going to be different, even though they have some of those same characteristics. Mm-hmm. So
that's interesting, because I had heard that with girls, people see it as a character trait. So they just say that's how that particular girl is, when it actually could be part of the autism spectrum showing itself. And, you know, I think you and I had talked about this. Savannah was diagnosed with nonverbal learning disorder, which is different than nonverbal autistic. However, because she spoke very young, she had a very large vocabulary. People would say, wow, how old is she? She could speak so well. But then it was much later, teen years, before we started realizing there's something else going on here. And so, yeah, and that is, there's a debate whether nonverbal learning disorder is on the autism spectrum or not. But would you consider your child a high functioning autism spectrum? If Savannah's on the autism spectrum, I would consider her high functioning, but that doesn't mean that there aren't any struggles that go along with that. Yeah.
So he's kind of got this like Swiss cheese development is what I always call it. You know, you have a piece of cheese and some of those are really nice and closed up. Other ones have big holes in it. Mm. So some people would classify him as high functioning because he's intelligent and understands like material that you give him for an academic purpose. Mm-hmm. He is more classified as a moderate just because he has a lot of missing skills within that skill set that he owns. Mm-hmm. I would never send him to a grocery store on his own. He would not be able to handle that. There's too many sights, sounds. He knows how to grocery shop. He goes with me, but to have to handle going through the grocery store, grabbing the stuff, paying for it at the counter and leaving, something in between there might trigger something that causes him to be upset and he might have a complete meltdown right there in the store. Mm. Or we just opened him. He's had a savings account, but until he had a learner's permit, I had never gotten a state ID. He wasn't able to have a checking account. So over Thanksgiving break, we opened up a checking account. And of course, you know, there's still a mask mandate at that point. He's not a great mask wearer. He wears it when he has to, but mm-hmm. he does have a lot of tics that he has. And one of them is this deep breath breathing thing that just causes the mask to go in and out, in and out, in and out of his mouth. So we were there. We had waited our time till our appointment. We got back to start opening his checking account. And by that point, he's kind of sweaty. He can't stand to be sweaty. He ripped his mask off and it was an older lady. She was probably somewhere in the 60s, you know, so somebody who maybe has not been around the autism spectrum as much. Mm. He ripped it off and she said, oh, excuse me, sir, but you're going to need to put that mask right back on. And he instantly got upset and used a curse word. And so without me there, that would have been badly. With me there, I just, oh, I'm so sorry that he took that off. If he scooted back just a little bit, I noticed you have plexiglass up and a mask on. Would he be able to leave it up for a couple minutes until he can put it back on when he's not as sweaty? He is on the autism spectrum. And she instantly flipped the switch and was like, oh, I've understood that. No problem. I want what's comfortable for you. Within a couple of minutes, he put it back on. Within 5 minutes, he said, I'm so sorry I did that. Mm. You know, he's always apologetic later. But at that point in time, you know, he still needs a person being there. I call it his whisper in his ear. Still needs that person there guiding him to what's socially appropriate. Because when he's hot, all rules of things that he know that are socially appropriate goes out the window. If something is overwhelming and upsetting to him, he feels like he doesn't understand what is going on, all social rules that he knows, politeness, manners, go out the window. It's an instant fight or flight response all the time. Luckily, it's not every day like it used to be. When he was young, it was every day. Now it happens in weird situations or in things that we're not maybe necessarily able to shape and mold for him that will be the best situation. So
those, for him to be hot and sweaty and that makes him uncomfortable, that's a sensory.
Yes, it definitely is. He definitely has some sensory processing disorder. So you'll have your sensory seekers. They seek out all kinds of sensory input. They want to be touched. They want to be hugged. They want to move. They want to run. They want to flip. They want to do all that. And then you have your sensory avoiders. He is definitely a sensory avoider. He avoids being hot. He avoids being overly cold. He avoids being in large, large places with overwhelming sounds and music and people.
Lights, flashing lights.
He avoids even like something as simple as Christmas Day at my parents' house, even though he's known all these people his whole life. He will isolate himself. He always has a room that is his safe room that once he's overwhelmed, he just goes to that room. He locks the door and he just is in there. He will spend 95% of his time in there at a family function. So he's definitely a big sensory avoider.
You know what? Savannah actually, one, she gets overwhelmed in grocery stores also. And she doesn't like to go to the store for me.
Right.
Ask her to now. And then two, she is also a sensory avoider. And when she was younger, I didn't understand it. There were certain things that she didn't like for moms. If you have younger kids, the seams of the socks.
Yes.
Both of my kids, that was an irritant. And I used to have to turn their socks inside out so they wouldn't feel the depth of the seam until someone told me about seamless socks.
Yes, so seamless socks are a lifesaver.
Yes, yes. Because it would always happen, the meltdown would happen before you were going to school because the last thing they did was put their socks and shoes on. And that would bother them. And so anyway, yeah, so I had to learn. And this was years earlier before it entered my mind, autism spectrum. So I'm glad I was willing to work with them and didn't just say, you know, suck it up and get out the house. You know, I was like, I'm going to flip it and let's get you going. Anyway, so yeah, that is a thing. And then when you said about the hugging, Savannah needs at least 3-4 hugs a day. And she will say that I need a hug. And so I will hug her. Although I would say, parents, hug your children without them asking for a hug. Because I read somewhere when you do that, it shows them that you need a hug too, that they're not just always asking for the hug. And so that it kind of helps them say, oh, this is good. This is a good thing. It's a normal thing for us to need to hug each other. But anyway, that's just something that I read.
Which I think is a great reminder because I'm not a hugger. I'm not really a toucher. And so I hug it like in certain certain things, but it's something that I have to initiate. If somebody initiates a hug with me, I'm like, oh, what they doing? But our 20-year-old daughter is a hugger and she wants to be hugged and she will ask for hugs just like Savannah. She will ask for hugs numerous times a day. And I'm like, oh, okay. Because it doesn't, being a non-hugger, it doesn't enter my mind that that's something that somebody craves. I'm
right.
Okay. You need a hug? Sure. So I need to get better at that. I try to get better at that where I just say, oh, I'm going to hug you. It doesn't come naturally to me, but it's definitely something I'm working on. So
yeah, same here. I am a hugger, but I'm not a 3-4 times a day hugger.
Right.
So yes, I have to also just be open to whenever she says, I need a hug. So you talk a little bit about how you have to be the whisperer in his ear. What other adjustments did you have to make as a family once you understood that your child was autistic and how it was going to just affect your way of living?
So it's definitely been a process. It's not something we came up with overnight. It's not something that stayed the same from what we started with originally. But one of the big things, so when he was diagnosed, our kids were 10, 7, he was 6, and the youngest was 3. One of the things that we really tried to do is he would have these tantrums that would last a really, really long time. And we would be trying to do the best for him to calm him down and get him going. And we would forget that the other kids in the house were hearing that and that they were either mad because that they were having to hear it. So each child reacted differently. Our oldest was frustrated and mad that he had to hear it. Our 7-year-old was just kind of like, whoa, and just kind of went and did her own thing. And our 3-year-old was terrified. Mm-hmm. She would sit in a corner and cry and cry and cry. And so that was something that like we had to find this balance of how do we support him and get him through these things, but not forget that our other children have needs and make sure that we were trying to meet those. So I'm going to admit, we have not been successful at that 100% of the time. There's times where his needs got put over their needs. There's times where we just had to eliminate doing some of the things in our house that we normally would have done. There's things we've had to adapt and compromise on. One of our biggest is we like to go on vacation. We want to show our kids parts of the world. We want to show them, not that we've went that, we've done a kind of a big circle around Nebraska, but we still want to give them that experience of experiencing outside the world. That's one of the things that's extremely hard for him, leaving the house. He wants to go, but the road trip itself could be miserable. We've learned that we cannot stay in a hotel if we're going to be there more than one night. If we're going to be there 3 or 4 nights, we need to have like a house that we rent, like Vrbo or Airbnb. Obviously, those are more accessible than they were 10 years ago when we were trying to take a vacation when he was littler. But we've learned every trip we've ever taken, we've learned more and more and more about what we need to do. Mm-hmm. Our last family trip was to Minnesota this summer. We went to Minneapolis, and we know that we can't have a big day followed by a big day followed by a big day. Mm-hmm. We need to incorporate breaks in there. And so we need to have like a big day where we talk. So we do a lot of social stories with him still at 18. Mm-hmm. We don't have to draw them out like we did when he was 4 or 5, where we drew out every single thing first. This is going to happen, then this. And we read it numerous times before we did something. Now we just talk him through it. We plan him through it. We tell him what's going to happen. So one of the big things that we've done is we do a big day and we plan it all out. He knows what's going to happen. But the next day, the rest of us might go have a big day. But now that he's old enough, he has access to where he could stay maybe at the house that we're renting. Mm-hmm. And he has a bond day. And we used to always think, oh, we can't do that. He's part of the family. We can't just leave him at the house playing his computer for 4 hours while we go to the aquarium. Well, we have found that he actually enjoys that and likes that and craves that. Mm-hmm. So that is something the mindset of what we've done as a family of getting through that has changed of sometimes that's what's best for him. And then we get to give that one-on-one attention to the rest of our kids and they get to do something that they really enjoy. To be quite honest, if we took him along and said he has to do it, it would ruin it for us. Mm-hmm. He would, the overstimulation, it would be nothing but complaint after complaint after complaint. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be fun for them. It wouldn't be fun for us. And it definitely wouldn't be fun for him. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that we've done. The other is we've done a lot of talking with them about what it looks like, what it feels like. Our oldest is 22. He's now in grad school and he's actually going to get his master's in clinical psychology. Mm. So he doesn't always necessarily have the patience he needs with his brother, but he definitely had the patience with other kids in his school. He always could see when there was something a little bit quirky, a little bit different. He had the eye for that. And he's like, Mom, did you know that here in the state of Nebraska, there is hardly any great quality psychologist for the need. He's like, there are some great psychologists, but you can't get into them. There's waiting lists. And we're like, mm-hmm. Yep, we know that. And so that's been a way that he has responded to it and adjusted to it as a family. As you know, in high school, he had a friend that was on the autism spectrum and he knew he was right away. The kid eventually told him, but the other kids didn't. And he would just say these weird, random, quirky things sometimes, and nobody would understand him. And they'd be like, oh my gosh. And they would be offended by him. And then Gabe finally said, guys, open, you know, everybody listen. And so he still was a big champion for him, even all the way through college, because they worked together at the zoo. And he just understood him where other kids didn't. So that's kind of where he's taken it. Our 20-year-old daughter, they're 16 months apart, her and our son that has autism. And she sometimes, even though they have a lot of similarities, of course, as a girl, she shows it different than he does, but she probably understands him the least. And I think it's because she feels those things too, but she can't understand why his are different. And then our daughter, who's 15 now, she was the one who would always be terrified of it. And she would be scared of him. Unfortunately, because they were playmates, he would take out some of his anger and frustrations out on her. She is just now starting to kind of understand him and wanting to understand him. Up to this point, she's just avoided him and ignored him, obviously talks to him if he's sitting there, but didn't go out of her way to try to understand him. Mm-hmm. So for parents of young children who have children with autism, it does get better, but it's definitely going to be a process. It's not going to be a straight line up. It's going to be ups, downs, ups, downs, ups, downs, sometimes really far up and a big far down, unfortunately, but it does get better.
Although you were a teacher, you still had to advocate for your son. How a parent can advocate and navigate the school system.
So I think your biggest thing is it's very confusing. Even though I knew all the terminology and I knew the educational acronyms, I knew all the things that they were telling me. I wrote IEPs. I understood it all. Mm-hmm. But my husband understood none of that. He was like, I don't know what they're saying to us. You know, what are they talking about? And that was confusing to him. Mm-hmm. So a big thing that I would say to advocate for your child is ask questions. Mm. Say, please stop. I don't understand what you're saying to me. Can you explain it in a different way? Can you spell that out for me? So that was one of the biggest thing is I had a tendency at the first few meetings to just go, oh, huh? Okay. Yeah. Yep. Get that. Yep. Because I knew what they were telling me and I knew what they were understanding. And then we would get home and my husband and I would have an extreme fight because he'd say, why did you say you understood that? I knew nothing that they were talking about. Mm-hmm. So the big thing is make sure that you do completely understand or that both of you understand. As we moved forward from those first couple of years, I would make sure to say, I understand what you're saying, but can you explain it to my husband? He's not an educator and he doesn't understand what you're saying. Or, you know, he just advocated for himself at that point. But to advocate for him, our biggest thing was to ask the questions. We are the ones who know our child best, but we also know that it's not always doable in a educational setting with one teacher and 25 other kids there. So we showed a lot of empathy of, we understand completely what you're saying. We see that at home as well. We know that can be hard to do in the classroom. Here's some things that we do that we think that would still be helpful for you. So we came at it after the first couple of years that were rough. We came at it as we're a team. We want to work with you. We want to be your partners and we can do what's best for him if we work together. We almost called it like our co-parenting, you know, our co-parenting relationship with like what parents would do if you're divorced. Mm-hmm. We're like, we need to do what's best for him. So we did a lot of making sure that the school knew that we were on their side. We completely understand everything you're saying. We want what's best for him and for you, but we also know that our child's our top priority. And if you insist that he wears a coat when it's 60 degrees, like every other kid, it's going to go badly for you. So here's some things that you can do to help that because, pick your battles,
right?
Because you're going to battle with him all day, every day over everything. So that was our biggest thing and that is what we continue to with it to this day is, you know, we're still in his senior year of high school. We've got one semester left. It seems a little long right now, but it's like, we're almost there. We're almost to the finish line of high school. It's definitely been a process. And we just have found that the school, if we go in with that positive attitude and like, please let us help you, they will go above and beyond for you. Or at least that has been our experience. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to go above and beyond for them as well. Mm-hmm. So like, it's not always the smooth sailing, but we've rarely had some time where the school isn't willing to meet us in the middle or take the suggestions that we have and, you know, at least try them. Right. We've actually in high school gotten to the point where, so not this last IEP, but his IEP is junior year. Mm-hmm. They had suggestions that I had written down on a piece of paper. They had suggestions the exact same that they presented to me before I ever had to get to mine. And I was like, oh, whoa, thank you. Yes, that's exactly what we were thinking. And so they just got to knowing well enough over this last couple of years that they kind of were like, hey, would it make sense for us? And are you okay with it if the teachers give him the notes and they just have a few blanks so that he's still kind of reading along, but he only has to fill in a few blanks instead of write everything down? I go, mm-hmm. yes, that mm-hmm. would be amazing. Mm-hmm. They're like, you know, in some classes where there's lots and lots to write, would it be okay if he just highlights the, you know, key points underneath the slideshow? And I'm like, yes, that would be mm-hmm. amazing. You know, mm-hmm. would it be okay if there's a lot of handwriting that we just had his para write it for him? Yeah, that would be great. You know, so they really tried, they just, especially the para he had his freshman, sophomore, and junior year, he understood him so well that he just knew which things that would make his education better for him and for everybody else.
You know, I had to do the same thing, mostly with Satchel, because when he was young too, I just started noticing, this is before he was diagnosed with ADHD, that it took him a while to tell us to answer a question and just some other things I had noticed. And so when I went into, I think by the time he was in second or third grade, when I went first few days of school, also, I would talk to the teacher, or actually first few days of school, I would write a note or an email to the teacher and let her know, this is what Satchel's like. You know, this, these are his likes. These are his dislikes. He's encouraged by this. And then I would schedule a meeting maybe 2 months later. I would mm-hmm. schedule a meeting with the teacher so I could see, okay, I just wanted to see what you see right now, if you're noticing anything. And then I would, like you said, we're a team. And if you need anything from me, please let me know. I'm here and available. And yes, there was a lot of teachers that were very receptive. But I would say also to be cautious of those who are not. And mm-hmm. if you have to get your child moved out of a classroom, that's okay. Because yeah. you do want to do what's best for your child. And if that particular teacher is not equipped or doesn't have the level of empathy that is needed for your child, it's okay to move your child out of that classroom. So
yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. We've really only had a couple of instances like that, but when we have, we really needed to advocate and try to say, hey, we do want to be your partners, but this isn't working. And you know, those meetings, just setting those up, is, we think, is super important. But yeah, definitely advocate for them if they're not in the right place, because you do know your child best and what they
yes.
need.
Yes.
I love that you said that you set those meetings up at the beginning of the school year. We did that same thing. And I felt like that sometimes really set the tone for the whole school year, knowing, hey, we're here, we're talking that. So that was something we started. He must have been a second grader. We just scheduled a meeting at the beginning of every year. When he transitioned to middle school and when he transitioned to high school, I know at first the high school thought I was kind of loopy. They were like, oh, it's November and he doesn't start till August. And I'm like, yeah, but here's the deal. Can we start talking? That really did help set a foundation for his high school. Like, they had heard enough from me and you know, me talking to them and me telling them things that I think, like, the first times they saw some of those things, they weren't shocked. They weren't like, whoa, he really does. You know, they were right. like, whoa, he really does do this. She wasn't just joking me. She wasn't just saying, oh, hey, this might happen. This did happen. And this is why. And just gave them that background.
Yeah. I noticed in middle school, okay, in elementary school, they want parents yeah. there. They want the room parent. They want someone to help with this and help with that. When right. they get to middle school, they're trying to wean you off and
yes,
wean your
are.
Child off of the dependency as to help them mature and grow. And I was the mom in elementary school. I didn't work when my kids were little. So I was there every opportunity I could be. I was there so much, people thought I worked there. They would say, well, you work at Campbell, don't you? No.
We loved your face there, though. We loved you being there.
Yes. And I like to know what was going on in the school. So, you know, and know the teachers and be able to see how my children were interacting with others, students and with the teacher. Although, you know, they're different when they know you're in the classroom.
They act
a little differently. So when they get to middle school is like, stay out, stay away.
They tell you, you can't even come eat lunch with your kids.
Yes,
like,
they don't, want you coming to lunch with them.
No, they do not.
They don't want anything.
Most middle schoolers don't want us to either, but sometimes they do. But I had it as far as they said, if you bring lunch for your kid, don't eat it with them. Just drop it off at the door and leave.
Yes.
I was like, oh,
yes.
Okay.
That was my experience too. However, and then even when you have the parent teacher conference at the school we went to, it was student led. So even the kids had to say, okay, this is what I'm doing. I had a little folder.
Yeah.
This is what I'm doing in class. This is what we're learning. And then the teacher was just there if the parent had any questions about what they were learning or whatever. But I made it a point once again to email the teachers, especially the ones where I knew were subjects that my kids struggled in. And math is always the one for both of them. And so I always emailed the math teacher and I would be, okay, this is the situation. This is the learning style. And, you know, if you have any questions, please let me know. And they were very responsive, even though, you know, you couldn't be there. They were still like, okay, yep, we're in this together. I get where you're coming from. I'll see if this helps. And Savannah had a teacher, I think Satchel had him for a little bit too, at Goodrich. And his name was Mr. Adams. He was awesome. He did so many hands-on things. And that class for Savannah, that's when math clicked because she could see it. It could be visualized. And so just because you can't be in the class or the school doesn't mean that you cannot still advocate. I say always, always, always advocate for your child because you know where their struggles are and you know what their needs are and how they're growing. And so, yeah. And then it's always good that the teachers do want to know, okay, yeah, if I have an issue or a question, I can talk to her and I know she'll be responsive. So they do appreciate that.
They do. I was going to say, I've had many teachers that have said, thank you for sending that email. I feel like I can reach out to you. And especially throughout, you know, some of my oldest never really needed me to send emails like that. But sometimes, you know, I did. That's just the type of parent I was with all of my kids, but especially with our son. I'd just be like, hey, this is the beginning of the semester. And hey, you might not know my kid yet, but you're going to have him. And here's some things that might help you. And here's some things that, you know, I'm always, and so, and I let him know I'm always available on phone. You can call me, you can text me, you can email me at any time of the day, and they've appreciated and followed through with it. You know, I've gotten emails at 9 o'clock at night that they're like, oh, in the morning, and this is going to happen. And I forgot to tell him, could you please let me know, you know, let him know. And I'm like, yep, I'll do that. Or emails like, oh, I know he doesn't do well when there's a sub. So this was just this first semester. And he's like, I have to be gone 3 days in a row. And I've had teachers that they just know if they put it on Google Classroom that I will teach it to him that night. Mm-hmm. So if it's a situation where they're going to be gone for a few days, he does study hall instead. Mm-hmm. And then I just teach it to him at home that night and it just works better. You know, they're proactive, which is nice. And I've appreciated that a lot. So,
yeah. So even just sending an email is helpful because, you know, they're parents who they just got a lot going on. You know, they have other stressors that they're dealing with that they can't always be at the school or whatever. Right. But even just sending the email so that teacher knows, okay, yes, I can respond or be responsive. And I know that this parent will also be responsive. Join us next time. Sherry will join us to talk about her family's experiences with her church. You know, you and I had a conversation about the church and how you did not feel that you were supported by your church community or your church leadership.
Join us next time to hear more. To get information about autism, check the links in the show notes.
Remember, God is for you and you're not alone. With His Spirit, you are filled with courage and strength of purpose. So don't fret, Mama. Instead, take heart.
Mama Take Heart is a production of Life Audio and the Salem Web Network. If you liked what you just listened to, would you take a second and leave us a rating in your favorite podcast app? It really does help more people like you find our show. This podcast is produced by me, Kelly Givens, and Steven Sanders, with executive oversight by Stephen McGarvey. You can find more podcasts like this over at lifeaudio.com.
Have you ever considered yourself a messenger? I mean, you are called by God, and aren't we all praying the big prayer, "Here I am, Lord, send me"? So if we put two and two together, you've got a message to deliver, my friend. Whether it's mics like this, bookshelves around the world, stages to take, art to make, or businesses to build, it's time we start testifying truth unashamedly, creatively, and in love. My name is Tamara Andress, the host of the Messenger Movement podcast, which is designed to catalyze Christians to speak, write, build, and testify. I use my mic like a machete, so if you don't like to get your toes stepped on or pushed off cliffs to finally jump on in with Jesus, I may be too much for you. But if you're ready to turn your message into a movement and want to run with other messengers doing the thing at scale globally, search and follow the Messenger Movement podcast on your favorite podcast platform or lifeaudio.com today.